everyone, and welcome to RadChat, the multi-award-winning first therapeutic radiographer-led oncology podcast. Welcome to podcast number 124. My name is Jo McNamara, and I'm joined by fellow host Namjoka Anderson.
Hi, everyone.
So a big thank you to our last guest, Katie Phillips, who discussed her experience of cancer and Talking with Cancer podcast. If you haven't had a chance yet, please do go and take a listen. So we're really pleased to introduce our next guest, Judith, who's going to be discussing her experience of cancer and the community group From Me to You, The Art of Survival that she founded. So welcome, Judith, to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I feel really honoured, actually. So, thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. We're so excited to talk to you. So, Judith, do you want to start by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, okay. Where do I start? I think if I start at the very beginning, that's just going to give you a little bit of insight as to why I'm where I am right now. I was actually a single mum. I had a daughter who was at school, was on her way to uni, just doing the general things that, I don't know, that mums do really, living life, working, paying bills. So in around about two, and prior to that, let me just give even more background. As a child, I was always told by my mum that I was a special baby in that I was born without a bile duct. So when I was a little girl, around about the age of 1 to 2, I had innovative surgery in that Lord Smith operated on me and made me a bile duct. So I was always aware that I was constantly under the team of consultants from a very early age. And I was aware of that. I knew the implications of that. But I was always told to just get on with life and that I would lead a normal life. So that was that, really. I did. And I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I didn't really look into it. I know that sounds crazy, but I trusted the professionals to do what they did, which was help people to live. And that's what professional doctors and medical profession do. Around about 2015, I became ill. I started to lose weight. I was constantly tired. My stomach was very bloated. And life, as I knew it then, just became unbearable. And at that point, I kind of remember feeling a bit like a ping pong ball, because I'd go to my GP and say, look, these are the signs, this is what's happening, I'm finding it really difficult to live here. And he would refer me to my consultant and said, look, it's a long-standing issue. And I would go to my consultant and my consultant would say, look, it's nothing to do with us. It's it's an issue for your GP. And that went on for nearly 3 years, from 2015 till 2018. In fact, on one occasion, I'd lost so much weight, and I was always quite a big girl. I went to my GP and I said, look, I've lost a lot of weight. I don't think this is normal. Can we do something? And I remember him turning round and he said to me, well, you always did need to lose a little bit of weight. And I tell that story for a specific reason. So in 2018, I had a meeting with my consultant and I broke down. And I broke down and I actually begged my consultant to do something, because, you know, the ramifications of that was that I couldn't work. I couldn't work, I couldn't pay bills. Life was becoming pretty unbearable. And he said, look, we always knew that we might have to operate, we're going and have a look. And they did. And on the 31st of July 2018, I came round from that operation. And I remember that when I came round, I knew enough about hospitals to know that when you see a team of doctors at the bottom of your bed, it's never really a great sign. So, and there were quite a few. And at that point, I kind of looked up and they said, look, we need to have a conversation. And I said, okay. And they said to me, you have cancer. So I was like, okay, what do we do? And they said, we're really very sorry, but there isn't anything that we can do. It's palliative, you know, it's terminal. And if anything, what we would say to you is to go home and prepare to die. And that was it. I could go into that there were a wave of emotions, panic, fear. But what I think what sticks in my mind was the fact that I just, a lack of understanding as to how this was happening. A lack of understanding that after 3 years of going back and forth, you know, through no want of my own, that I was in a position where my life was over. And then I asked them about time and they said to me, under a year. And I now know that my daughter, who is my advocate, that they actually pulled her aside and said to her that I had 3 months to live. So there were a lot of mixed emotions around that. But that was the start of my journey. After that, I'm going to skip quite a few bits because there's quite a few bits within that and I'm not going to bore you with the tedious details. But I left hospital and I started to look at what my options were. And one of the things that struck me was that I can always remember thinking that two things. One, that if you had a cancer diagnosis, that it was like a conveyor belt, that you got on. Some people made it and some people didn't. But the belt, the conveyor belt that you were on, well, everybody got on that conveyor belt. And, you know, it definitely wasn't down to race or inequalities as to whether you lived or died in relation to that. So that was my first point. And I think the other point that really stuck in my mind was up until that point, you know, we have these things where the NHS is person-centred. And for me, because I was a psychotherapist, and that was my what I did prior to that, person-centred to me meant client-led. So when at that point I'd said that, okay, I accept your diagnosis, but actually I want to live. I need to live because I have a child. And I know that many people have children, but that was my driving force. And I wasn't asking necessarily to live forever, just for more time. And I believe that at that point, you know, I think everybody has the right to be heard, right? Whether it falls in with what the common, whether it's your diagnosis or not, you have a right to live. You have a right to disagree, you know, freedom of speech and so forth, you know. So at that point, when I decided that I wasn't necessarily, and being the stubborn person that I am, I wasn't going to take that track, that road, I felt that, you know, there should have been things in place to help me to do that. And the biggest shock for me was that there wasn't anything in place for me at that point in time. There were many organisations that would help me to die, I felt at that point in time, but not necessarily to live. And when I say to live, I don't mean in the sense that, you know, because there are a lot of organisations out there that do incredibly good work. You know, Macmillan, Cancer Research, to name but a few, Prostate Cancer UK, there are huge organisations that provide awareness and do a lot of good work. But what I'm talking about is in relation to the day-to-day things that you might need in order to live, such as research. Somebody to come in and advocate for you when you can't advocate for yourself, yeah? And at that point in time, I felt incredibly alone. Because it was just myself and my daughter. And at that point in time, my daughter was, again, I'll reiterate, she was 18, 19. She was having conversations with teams of doctors and, you know, other organisations that were twice her age. And that's a very hard conversation to navigate as a young girl. And I felt that there should have been something in place to support her in that. So to jump forward a few years on, when I had navigated a clearer pathway for myself, what I wanted to find out, what I needed to know at that point, was I the only person who was going through that? And also, one of the main things that I found along my journey was that, and I know it's an uncomfortable conversation, but what hit me really harshly, and I think that was one of the hardest things to live with, to work with, was that there were inequalities in healthcare. And I don't know why, you know, being a black woman, is inequality something that I've never had to face? Of course I have, you know, of course. But for some reason, in my mind, I just felt that health was definitely an area that it would not cross over into. And I'm really sad to say that, that wasn't the case. So at that point, well, not on my journey anyway. So at that point, I set up a face group. And I set it up for the black community. And I say, when I say that for a specific reason. Not because cancer discriminates, because we all know that it doesn't, you know. But definitely the policies and procedures that we have in place do, you know. So I definitely wanted to know if I was the only person affected by that, if it was just through my viewpoint. And unfortunately, and I say unfortunately, because although our organisation has grown considerably, it's the type of growth, just like cancer, that nobody wants to grow, you know. It shouldn't be here. Just like cancer, from me to you, which is the name of our organisation, from me to you, the art of survival, it shouldn't have grown. There shouldn't actually be a need for it. Okay, so fast forwarding, the group grew, and what we found was that there were many similar themes amongst us all. One of the main themes was that the feeling of not being heard, not being seen. Definitely an issue that came into play, and I'm skirting over a number of issues just to give a general focus as to why we exist. But one of the issues that we also found in that is that whole issue of, and when I say this, it's to do more so with marginalised communities. And I'm sure the people who could put this across far more eloquently than what I will. But within marginalised communities, there's that whole power and privilege, you know, element that comes into the room. And it definitely wasn't being looked at, and it definitely wasn't being tackled, and it wasn't an open conversation. So, yeah, that's how, from me to you, came into existence, and unfortunately that's how we grew to be, and that's why we're still growing, because we look at inequalities in healthcare, we look at advocacy, we look at research, and we look at raising awareness. And what I do know is that within our community, within marginalised communities, that we are helping people to live. And whether there's a need for, whether, you know, we should exist or not, there is definitely a need. Unless you can hear, I'm quite passionate about that. I'm very passionate that, you know, whether somebody lives or dies, should not, you know, race should not be indicative of that. It should not even come into question. We live in a time when that, to me, is absurd. And what we also try to do, as well as from me to you, is not just to look at marginalised communities. You know, we know the issues that lie there. It's within our own community. And I'm not saying that they don't need to be tackled. Of course they do. But I think that just as an important part of that, and I think it's a conversation that's long overdue, is that we need to be looking at the organisations who help to uphold the systems that are in place, and I think this is going to make me hugely unpopular, that are in place and that are not working, because they've not been working for a considerable amount of time. So how long do we keep looking at something or working with something that clearly doesn't work? And why are we not turning to the experts in the room? In every other field, if you need, you know, a laptop fixed, you go to a laptop engineer, you know, it's as simple as that. So why then, in relation to engagement with those communities, are we not going to the people within those communities and allowing them to help to fix the problem? Because while we actually talk about this, think about it, people are dying. I have people in my group that are dying constantly, and it's very difficult to be tactful when you're holding people's hands who are dying needless deaths. So that's a little bit about what I do. I hope, I hope I filled you in a bit.
Thank you, Judy. No, that's perfect for kind of explaining how it came to be. The question that everyone will be wanting to know is, how are you still alive, Judy? Because you skirted over that point, that you woke up, you had a team of medics around you that said you had 3 months to live, and yet we're in 2024 now and you look amazing. What happened?
I've had another team of medics that believed that I could live. It was as simple as that. I mean, I'm really embarrassed to say that up until I was diagnosed, I knew very little about the hospital system, you know, the medical profession and how it worked. I'm even embarrassed to say, like, one of the things that came to me and that happened to me very early on in my journey is that when I was diagnosed, I didn't know what the primary cause of cancer was. And the team that I was under at that point, they did tests and they said, you know, it's inconclusive. We just know you've got a stomach cancer and it needs to be looked at. We need to start treatment. But from the little knowledge that I had gleaned, I was also very aware that, you know, that was quite important. And then I started on a journey of just, you know, my daughter and I of researching. And what we found was that one of the main hospitals for primary unknown cancers was the Christie in Manchester. And I was kind of baffled because I was like, okay, that's not abroad. It's in the UK. So why were my notes not sent there? If you couldn't find it. And it was as simple as that that started that ball of, okay, that actually said to me at that point, I really need to engage in my care plan, because something with that is not right. You know, it should be a straight transfer, as far as I was concerned. I mean, and luckily I rang up the Christie and they were amazing. And they gave me my results within under a week and told me conclusively that it was bile duct cancer. So I became aware very early on that if I wanted to live or had any hope of extending my life, that I had to be involved in that care plan. And I think one of the main things that come to me is that a lot of people from marginalised communities are not engaging effectively with their care plans. But it is actually that important, you know, that it can make the difference between life and death, whether you engage or not. And again, that's one of the things that we that we are very, you know, we promote quite a bit at From Me to You, is engagement in your care plan. How do you engage? What are the questions that you need to be asking? And if you don't get the answers that you need, what can you then do? Because there's always an option, right? You know, whether we decide to, you know, to take on board what we've been told, that's fair enough. Everybody has a right to do what they want to do. But we do have a right, as an individual, as a human being, a basic right to have choice, you know. And unfortunately, if nobody's going to give you that choice, then you have to engage in that. For me, engagement was a huge part of the process of staying alive. Once I realised that I had to engage, everything really fell into place quite easily for me, I have to say. Was it hard to find a team who wanted to help me. Of course not. Because the medical profession are full of, you know, that's why people get involved in the medical profession. Dare I say, you don't do it for the love of money, you know, you do it because you care about people, ultimately. So was there a team that was willing to help me to live? Yes, I'm under an amazing team. I'll chat their names from the rooftop. I'm going to say it, Dr. Wasan, you know, he heads Hammersmith, you know, and he's my oncology team, are part of my oncology team. Mr. Wadsworth, he's an amazing consultant who actually put me on a clinical trial that I believe has been, you know, one of the main reasons why I'm sitting here today. But, you know, did I have to look for them? Of course, yeah, I did. You know, but have they done everything they can to help me? Yes, they have, and more so, you know. And I've never met a medical professional who doesn't want to help. That's not the issue here. The issue is about, you know, how do you engage effectively with the communities that you are there to help? And that's the fall down, engagement. And are we engaging in the right way? I'm not here to, like, send a sledgehammer towards the medical profession because I wouldn't be alive. That's not what I'm here for. But I am here to say, you know, do we need to look at the systems, the processes and the policies and procedures that we have in place? Yes, we do. And I think that's an open and honest conversation, right? In my opinion.
You don't need to add in your opinion. You know we're on your side here. Completely agree. It's difficult not to get passionate about something. I mean, you put it so eloquently. It's your life. It's life or death. I mean, we in healthcare, we're trained, we're taught everything, but there isn't, you know, we can't always do everything. And while we don't want patients to have to be Googling things and being their own advocate, you're completely right. You have to be your own advocate. It's your life. You know,
absolutely.
A healthcare system is there to support you and help you. Yes, the NHS is struggling, but whatever happens, we'll do whatever we can to help. But at the same time, if you don't get the answer you want, you do need to fight for it. And I think even healthcare professionals, we fight for our patients where we get. So obviously there's a multidisciplinary team that might look at a patient and decide, no, they're not fit enough to go ahead for this. But some of us sit at that table and say, well, have we thought about how we could maybe get their fitness back up so they can have this treatment? Because otherwise it is palliative, end of life versus radical and maybe a cure. So yeah, it's really important. So thanks for putting it. And I think the psychotherapy example you said of it's client-based or client-led, that's personalised care. You know, we go on and on and on and on and on about personalised care in the NHS, but we don't offer it. We think we do. In some cases, we might do to an extent, but I don't think it's as good as we think it is. It's in all the NHS long-term plans and stuff, but we've not been delivering it properly for ages. I mean, let's be honest about that. And I'm happy to say absolutely. That's not just my opinion. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people's opinion.
No, I totally reiterate that. And, you know, I say it to people all the time. I have a group where, you know, I constantly get people coming to me and say, you know, we need to look at clinical trials. We need to look at why these communities, you know, marginalised communities are not engaging in clinical trials. And I actually always say, you know, I don't understand that. Because if you said to somebody, you know, terminal, you're going to die, or would you like to try a clinical trial? It's a no-brainer as to what you're going to do. You know, you're going to try the clinical trial. That's universal, right? So when people say to me, why are, you know, marginalised not engaging? Well, maybe it's because they haven't got access to that information. Because actually, it's not about the want to live, is it? So maybe we, again, need to be looking at how is that information distributed? You know, are we putting that information out to everybody? And it's not necessarily, you know, and are we necessarily making assumptions? I have two people within my group who recently passed away. As you can see, I'm quite passionate about that. They died of prostate cancer, which we know 1 in 4 black men die of prostate cancer. And the issues that came into place were why we were called in was to advocate for them because they didn't feel that they were being heard. And that was an issue, you know. They were not being heard. They were not being listened to. And when we did ask for clinical trials, they weren't given the right information. And I'm not saying that that was done deliberately. Of course it wasn't. But there's a whole issue with that of, you know, I mean, I don't know if you, I mean, obviously you guys know when, you know, if you're offered a clinical trial, if you're very ill, I believe it's levels 2 and 3 are not applicable, but maybe 1 is, stage 1, is that correct? You'll have to correct me on that if I'm wrong. But they were brought clinical trials that were clearly not relevant to them and they couldn't partake in. And by the time they were brought the correct clinical trials that maybe they might have been, you know, able to take part in, it was too late. So there's a lack of communication, a lack of understanding and a lack of being heard. And these are all things that unfortunately or fortunately can be fixed, right?
How are we going to fix it, Judith? What do we, if you had a meeting with the health secretary tomorrow and he said, Judith, I understand what you're saying, what can we do? What would be the kind of front-running sentence, you know, your elevator pitch to the health secretary to go, this is what you need to do? Because you've got the most experience, haven't you? You know, you've come on the podcast, you've had real life experience, you've fought for your life and you're supporting marginalised communities every single day. What is it that they need to change and implement?
Thinking very carefully about this because I'm aware of my organisation.
You are live. Please do not swear.
I would say that instead of, you know, instead of wasting huge amounts going to organisations that don't actually know what these communities are thinking, feeling or actually need to be done. Let's go back to basics. Let's go back to grassroots. Let's go into the communities. Let's enable them to find out the very information that you actually need to move forward on this. Yeah? It's as simple as that. Let's go to the experts in the room and let's not go through Chinese whispers, because clearly what happens when we go through that whole process of Chinese whispers, that we employ organisations to have various different groups, you know, the quality of the message gets lost down the line and we end up with something that is not fit for purpose. That's what I would say. Let's go directly to the source, shall we? And let's actually listen to what we're being told. And not what we want to hear.
Perfect, Judith. And I'm sure if they were able to kind of spend time with you, they'd realise how passionate you are about kind of supporting advocacy for patients and making a change, making a difference. So I hope someone out there is listening to you. Judith, what's next for the charity?
Oh gosh, we have so many things in line. What we're passionate about is, I think that you've already established, is education and training. Because I don't think anything changes with that, without that. So we want a two-pronged approach. We believe that the community needs to be engaged in workshops to allow them to feel empowered, to question and to engage effectively in their care plans, because that's the cusp of it, isn't it? You know, how they engage. Do they feel able to challenge? Let's look at that whole power and privilege, whole aspect of it. What stops us as a community, you know, challenging things that we don't necessarily understand and having that conversation, yeah? So that's one of the things that we're working on, which are workshops throughout, you know, the UK, hopefully, or through London at the moment. The other thing that we're looking at is we do that. You know, it's pointless just looking at education into the community if we're not going to actually go into the third sector and actually look at the powers that be, the larger organisations who actually implement these processes and procedures, policies and procedures, and not actually say, you know, look, let us come in. Let us help you to help us. By looking at the language you use, by looking at your policies, by looking at your procedures, are we reflective in that? You know, we've long known that there's an issue with mistrust. People trust organisations that they can see themselves reflected within, right? are we there? Can we trust you? And what are you doing to, in order to aid that? You know, so yeah, training is a massive part of what we would like, of what we're hoping to deliver in the new year. And we are passionate about that. We hope that other healthcare providers are just as passionate about providing that education to their organisations as we are about saving lives, you know, and we humbly ask them to look at what we're doing.
I think the bit you said earlier as well about power and privilege is something I really hope people take away, because when you want to engage with a different community and you're not from that community, you have the power and the privilege, but it's also your prerogative that you should be trying to help them. I think over the past 18 months, the amount of people I've spoken to have said, oh yeah, we really want to be more diverse with our research. Okay, have you printed stuff in different languages? No. Have you got someone from that community to go and speak to them? No. Then why have you stopped? It's like, oh, well, no one engaged. It's like, well, they're not going to. If someone went into my community in India and they're in a suit when it's like 50 degrees, don't speak the right language and are white, everyone would just tell them to piss off. That's never going to work.
Yeah.
I think, again, absolutely, as you said, it's 2024 and we're still not engaging with communities properly. Some of the bigger organisations are getting better, but they're still trying to do it from the internal side. So, oh, maybe there's a token person within our team who could help because they're black or because they're Indian.
I think you've hit on the nail on the head. It's about tokenism, not representation, you know, and there's a difference. And I really think we need to look at that. I mean, I'm just going to give you one, and probably shouldn't say, but I will, as I usually do. I went to a meeting to provide advocacy. There was a young man, he's died. He has since died. He had a brain tumour. He was 25 years of age, and his mother, they were of African descent. He was the main person within the family who spoke on their behalf predominantly. His dad had died from cancer 20 years prior. His mum was absolutely befret. She knew that she was losing her son. She didn't kind of understand. I was called into a meeting to advocate because he was palliative. The consultant, we were called into the meeting, and it still, you know, shocks me that when we got called into the meeting, because we questioned some of the care plan, the consultant who led that discussion, she got up and said that she felt victimised by the barrage of questions and that she was going to remove herself because she felt quite vulnerable. There was a young man who was losing his life. There was his mother who was going to lose her son. And that whole power and privilege of feeling that it was okay to say that you felt vulnerable in that situation. And there was only, you know, there was another CNS nurse there. That stays with me. You know, the fact that that she felt at ease to use the language of aggressive, I'd say passionate, by his mother, still haunts me. And that was the last meeting that young man had with that team, and he has since passed on. I don't think we're in a time in place, and maybe, you know, some people might negate from what I'm saying, but I don't think any mother should have to experience that, you know? And if there are conversations like that that are still taking place, then don't we really need to look at language and education? That can't be right. Sorry.
Thank you so much. No, don't ever apologise. No, thank you so much for sharing everything. So, Judith, if someone wanted to get involved with the foundation or needed the help, what would they need to do?
They would need to contact info@frommetoyou.co.uk, and I will send that to you, because if you ask me to say it any clearer, I think I've said to everybody that technically I'm not great. So I will send over all of our handles and everything to you. So apologies for that in advance.
No, that's brilliant. We'll share them far and wide on your behalf. So Judith, we always end Rad Chat episodes with top tips. So do you have a top tip for any listeners out there that you'd like them to take away from this episode?
Top tip is to definitely tune in to Rad Chat on a regular basis, because I think you guys are absolutely amazing. What you're doing is revolutionary. I'm just so proud to be a part of it. And actually, Naman, I just want to say, and Joe, I just think you're absolutely amazing people. And Naman, for what you've done, I think that, you know, as a community, we need to thank you. Because before you, there was nothing like what you've done. So thank you. It's going to save lives. And I don't think my thanks will ever be enough. So thank you. Yeah, that's my top tip.
Thank you, Judith.
Oh, it's made me quite emotional, that. And it is very true. The work that Naman is doing is absolutely amazing. And it's great to kind of ensure that that, again, gets publicised far and wide so people can appreciate all the amazing work that happens behind the scenes. But Judith, thank you for kind of promoting Rad Chat, but we will absolutely have to thank you as well for coming on to Rad Chat and sharing your experience and everything that you've been through. Before we finish, how are you now?
I take every day as it comes, and I thank, you know, I don't know if it's popular to say this, I thank God for every day that comes to me. I believe that there's a purpose. I think we all have a purpose. And I don't think that cancer necessarily has to, it's not great, but I think if you can find your purpose in it, then it's a good thing. And if it helps one other person in life, then it's a great thing, right? So, yeah, I'm good.
Judith, can I ask a difficult question? Would you, if you had your time again, if you could go back, we had a time machine, would you still have had cancer? If you had that choice to, you know, turn things around, given all the amazing work you do, which is a really difficult question, and if you can't answer it, it's absolutely fine. But I just wonder, is that something that you would do? Would you eradicate having had cancer?
If I could eradicate it for everybody, yeah, of course. but I can't, and I do believe that everybody in life has a purpose. Just like the fact that I'm still here today, 5 years on from my diagnosis, there's a purpose in that. And I think if you find your purpose, then that can be the most amazing thing ever, because we're all here. And to know what your purpose is, well, you can't ask for more than that, can you? Cancer or no cancer. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So thank you all for listening to Rad Chat. Your hosts today have been myself, Jay McNamara, and Naman Joel Anderson. If you're utilising this podcast for CPD purposes, consider the reflective questions posted along with links to resources and literature that we've discussed. To receive your accredited CPD certificate, please complete the Google form. Our next guest to feature will be Dr. Alison Berner, who will be discussing her career, her gender identity clinic work, and PhD research. Thank you all for listening, and take care.